standing ground. We shall fight in the field.
Statsbøttekottet.
Vår slagårde
er mer demokrati, mer åpnet og mer statsbøttekottet.
Hei og velkommen til en ny serie om komparativ politikkdelen av Politusen. Med oss i studio for hele denne serien postdoktor Kathleen Jennings.
Postdoktor Jennings foreleser for KP-delen av Politusen og amerikansk. Vi har derfor bestemt oss for at denne serien spilles inn på engelsk.
God fornøyelse.
Statsbøttekottet!
Hello and welcome to this episode of Statsbøttekottet with me, Lars, and Andreas.
This is one of four episodes in the summary podcast series in Poll 1000 for comparative politics. This podcast series will try to summarize the syllabus on the subject. The series is not intended as a substitute for reading the syllabus, but as a supplement.
During this series, we will cover the topics key concepts and state formation, Möller's control logic, forms of rule and ideology, and state structure and governance.
For this series, we are proud to have Kathleen Jennings, postdoctor and lecturer in Poll 1000, as our guest. Postdoctor Jennings has studied both at Stanford and Oxford, and she took her doctorate in political science at the University of Oslo. She's lecturing here at NTNU in Poll 1000, Comparative Politics. Welcome to our podcast, Postdoctor Jennings.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Thank you.
The theme for this episode is Mueller's control logic. To start us off, what is Mueller's control logic and why is it such an important tool for understanding and using comparative politics?
I mean, what Mueller is getting at and what, you know, we have to try to understand just as a sort of a basic kind of requirement to do comparative politics. Again, comparative politics is about comparing things. And if you're wanting to compare things as complicated as states or institutions or cultures, you can't take it all together. You have to find ways to compare essentially what it is you're trying to know and to hold as much in a way steady or controlled as possible. Because if you kind of just throw tons of variables into the pot, you don't know which variable or which explanation is actually responsible. So you don't know what's causing the thing you're looking at if you haven't controlled for anything. Then you could just sort of, you might as well just, pick at random what you think the explanation is, because there's no way of sort of disaggregating what's actually causing. So what Mueller is basically taking us through is how these different logics and sort of methods work in a comparative context. If your goal is to compare, you have to ask yourself, you know, what am I actually trying to compare? What is my research question? I might think I'm comparing this, but actually, no, I'm really more interested in this, you know, breaking it down into something that is possible to compare. And then how do I do that in a way that allows me to kind of separate out the stuff that I don't think really matters necessarily, or that I think is really interesting, but not necessarily, you know, relevant to my question, so that you can really start to hone in on finding different possible explanations for what it is you want to know. So the only way to do that is to eliminate or sort of neutralize other things that sort of confuse the picture by adding in too much. And so that is doing a control logic, trying to control for what it is you're trying to figure out.
In Jürgen Müller's book, he asks the question, how did capitalism and democracy emerge in the West and why not elsewhere? To answer that question, he refers to various theorists. Which theorists would you consider most relevant?
I mean, I think it's a difficult question to answer because, I should stress that in terms of the exam, I would recommend everyone read the pensum. So what I say here is not in any way indicative of the questions that might be on the exam. But I mean, certainly Weber is, you know, the fundament. You have to understand Weber because a lot builds out from him and his arguments. I would say the first kind of block of especially Weber and Schumpeter are quite important. I thought it was kind of interesting that he focuses so much on Moore and Anderson, who were in a way, empirically speaking, discredited quite quickly. So, I mean, I think that their work was important in kind of pushing a research agenda, but it hasn't actually kind of stood up over time. I think Schopol is very important, and Tilly, especially if we're talking about sort of political science today, those are two names that are very much in sort of current use also today. They're not considered kind of like the old, you know, old scholars from 100 years ago that you don't have to relate to, or that you only kind of relate to in a very basic way. They're actually still very salient within today's political science. So I would say that they are also very important. But certainly you should have a familiarity with all of the names in the pensum, at least be able to understand their main arguments in order to be prepared for the exam.
Moller's book does of course cover the different theorists, but it's also described as like his method, his control logic. And could you kind of define the difference between causality and correlation?
Yeah, so this is a really important question, and it's one that political scientists themselves, you know, tend to sometimes mix up a bit. So causality is basically you're making the claim that something causes something else. A causes B. Without A, there is no B. Whereas correlation is a weaker claim, right? So causality, you're kind of staking out a pretty strong position that this causes that, X causes Y. Correlation, you're more pointing to that there are connections between things, but you can't establish or show that there is an actual sort of causal relationship between them. And in fact, with correlation, often the causal chain is very unclear. Is it A that causes B or B that causes A, right? So correlation is in a way a less strong claim. So you're saying that this and that and that and that, usually you have a lot of kind of variables in the mix. They're correlated because they're kind of, you find them happening in the same circumstances or in similar circumstances. They tend to kind of show where one is, the other tends to show up maybe weaker or stronger, but you can't actually establish a causal relationship. And in fact, most political science, in my mind, lives in correlation rather than causation. But for a lot of, especially quantitative political scientists, the goal is causation, to be able to show that something causes something else. But usually it's very hard to do in any kind of a sort of absolute way. You often end up in the space of correlation.
Another question on like his method. What is the difference between necessary and sufficient causes?
I mean, basically... It's again a sort of a difference of degree. So if you have something that is a necessary cause, that means that without that thing, the other thing won't exist. So I'm trying to think of a good metaphor for this, but it's difficult on the fly. But basically, you need to have ice cream to have an ice cream sundae. I mean, I guess technically you could have like gelato or something else. But, you know, if you don't have any kind of nice, delicious, cold, creamy thing, you don't have an ice cream sundae. It doesn't exist, right? Whereas a sufficient cause is, again, kind of a weaker, it's enough that it's there, but the connection between that being there and the sort of outcome is not as clear, right? And you could take it away and that thing could still exist. So a sufficient cause isn't as strongly linked to whatever it is you're trying to explain. It might be there, but the thing won't collapse without it in a way. And it's, and again, this coexists with other causes. So a sufficient cause wouldn't be the only cause for a thing because it's not in and of itself necessary.
Which models kind of does Moller use, or like methods to compare different states or how different theories look at different states?
I mean, Moller is kind of taking us through a bunch of different models, and he's also taking us through the kind of case studies and how those are used comparatively. And I mean, he definitely has, I would say, preferences. But I mean, his preference really is about, you know, this control logic. And he is very one of these political scientists who I think does like the notion of causality. But he, I wouldn't say that Miller has a model. I would say that his point of the methodology chapter is to outline different methods that have been used, and then, insofar as possible, to take the theorists who he then takes us through in the sort of substantive parts of the book, and show what methods they were using, which is harder than it sounds, because most of the time, for the older theorists in particular, they weren't actually using, they didn't have kind of a methodology that was spelled out. So he's essentially taking what we now understand as these methodologies and sort of putting them backwards onto scholars that themselves didn't think in those terms.
One concept in a lot of methodologies for researching political science is the concept of like path dependency. In short, what is path dependency?
I mean, path dependency is basically saying that once a sort of decision is made, or once a sort of chain of an events is put in motion, oftentimes at a critical juncture, political scientists would say, that once a certain path has gone down, all the subsequent or later outcomes sort of are dependent on that path, or they branch off that path. So if you imagine you have a fork in the road where you could go either one direction or the other, at that point, you can choose going left or right. But if you choose to go left, you're following that path, and whatever path branch off of it, you will follow one or the other, but you will never get onto the right, to the path that you would have followed if you'd gone to the right. So basically what it says is that certain, not everything, I would think, political scientists don't argue that necessarily everything's path dependent, but most political scientists would tend to agree that there are certain very, again, critical moments where certain choices are made, maybe in the writing of a constitution, maybe in the settlement of a peace, maybe in the decision to go to war, that send countries or regimes down a particular path, which then informs all these later outcomes, even though at the time, of course, you can't predict what that's going to look like.
Okay, so how does Miller relate to comparative politics?
This is a good question, because there is a reason we put Miller in the pensum, and the reason why is because Miller provides a good kind of introduction to some of the key methodological issues in comparative, varieties in comparative politics. And Munnard also provides a good, if kind of dense, introduction to some of the main concepts. So again, Munnard's interested in states and state development. He's interested in democracy. He's interested in sort of capitalism and how all these things hang together. But what I would say is that Munnard should be seen as an introduction to these topics, or a way to kind of start understanding them. But comparative politics itself is much broader than Mallard. A lot of comparativists don't have this same sort of historical grounding as he has. And so they're relating to questions that are much more, I would say, modern, or some might say relevant to sort of today's societies, relating to how elections work and how, you know, certain outcomes and political parties and stuff like that. So Mullern is a good way to get into some of these concepts and to give you a sense of the historical sort of development of them. But Mullern is definitely not the sort of be-all, end-all of comparative politics.
Thank you very much for the talk, Postdoctor Jennings. This conversation has certainly helped me a lot.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
And then we wonder if you have any like general tips for the exam or the exam time.
I mean, my general tip would be, besides do the reading and look at the lecture notes, which are very comprehensive, the slides, there's a lot of words, would be not to get hung up on very small details. Without saying what's going to be on the exam, I can say that there's not going to be any kind of trick questions that if you haven't read page 72 of Mullid, you're not going to be able to answer the question. Like, we're not trying to trap people. What we're trying to do is test sort of, if you have a solid understanding of some of these basic concepts and the sort of basic sort of what we've been discussing here in terms of institutions, in terms of some of the historical stuff, in terms of some of the methods, and can just sort of relate to these things in a sort of comprehensive enough way that shows that you have actually understood what's in the pensum, what we've been talking about in the lectures. But you don't need to know like all the very, very, very details. The main thing is to be able to tell a story about how all these things hang together and to understand how the different parts of these systems work sort of in concert or sort of pull against each other.
We hope this has been helpful for the exam study, and thank you for listening. We want to remind you again that the curriculum podcasts cannot replace reading, but are intended to supplement the busy exam period.
We also recommend following along because this podcast series has several other parts.
Fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing ground, we shall fight in the field.
Statsbøttekottet.
Mer demokrati,
mer åpenhet, og mer statsbøttekottet.